My name is Bob Farmer, and I'm a real alcoholic.
Hi, Bob.
We'd like to welcome you to the Big Book Study this week. And Butch and I were on the way down here, and Butch asked me if I was nervous, and I said, well, yeah, a little bit. And he said, really no need for us to be nervous, because all we're going to do is talk about what's in the book. It ain't me and you, it's the book, it's the program itself. And I thought we'd sort of start off with a little story, not necessarily a true story, you know. Because I have told you that not all my stories are true. I made that statement in a meeting one night, and this fellow said, but this is an honest program. I said, hell, I know when I'm lying. Rigorous self-honesty. This is a story about an old boy that was in his automobile, and he was weaving, and the police stopped him, you know, and they pulled him over, and they told him, said, going to have to get you to blow up this balloon. And he said, it won't do any good. He said, I've got emphysema, and I can't blow it up. And he said, well, I'll have to get some blood from you then. And he said, can't do that either, because I'm a hemophiliac, and we wouldn't stop the bleeding. And he said, well, we'll have to go downtown and I get a urine sample then. And he said, can't do that either, because I'm a diabetic. And by this time, the cop was getting a little excited, you know, a little perturbed. So he told him, he said, well, there's one damn thing you can do. You can get out of that car and walk this line. And the old boy said, well, I can't do that either. And he said, why? He said, because I'm drunk. We're going to be going through the book. We'll read a little. We'll make comments. We're going to start with the foreword to the first edition. We're going to do a little history of the AA program on page X and 3Is, 13, I believe, in the Roman numeral. We of Alcoholics Anonymous are more than 100 men and women who have recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body to show other alcoholics precisely how we have recovered is the main purpose of this book. It does say that they're going to show us precisely how they recovered. And then they're going to tell us, they're going to explain to us the problem they had, the solution they found, and the planned program of action that they took to bring about recovery. We hope these pages will prove so convincing that no further authentication will be necessary. We think this account of our experience will help everyone to better understand the alcoholic. Many do not comprehend that the alcoholic is a very sick person, and besides, we are sure that our way of living has its advantages for all. We'll start in the history in the foreword of the second edition, down at the bottom of page 15, XV. The spark that was to flare into the first AA group was struck at Akron, Ohio in June of 1935, during a talk between a New York stockbroker and an Akron physician. 6 months earlier, the broker had been relieved of his drink obsession by a sudden spiritual experience following a meeting with an alcoholic friend who had been in contact with the Oxford groups of that day. He had also been greatly helped by the late Dr. William D. Silkworth, a New York specialist in alcoholism, who is now accounted no less than a medical saint by AA members, and whose story of the early days of our society appears in the next pages. From this doctor, the broker had learned the grave nature of alcoholism. Though he could not accept all the tenets of the Oxford group, he was convinced of the need for moral inventory, confession of personality defects, restoration to those harmed, helpfulness to others, and the necessity of belief in and dependence upon God. Prior to his journey to Akron, the broker had worked hard with many alcoholics on the theory that only an alcoholic could help an alcoholic, but he had succeeded only in keeping himself sober. The broker had gone to Akron on a business venture which had collapsed, leaving him greatly in fear that he might start drinking again. He suddenly realized that in order to save himself, he must carry his message to another alcoholic. That alcoholic turned out to be the Akron physician. Now, Bill had been talking to alcoholics around New York, but he had been trying to tell them about his spiritual experience. And he went back to Dr. Silkworth and he told him, he said, "I'm not having any success at all with this carrying the message and getting another alcoholic sober." And Silkworth said, "Well, at least you're staying sober yourself." He said, "Bill, you're hitting them with a spiritual experience and they can't accept that. Hit them with the medical fact that I gave you, that they are allergic to alcohol and have an obsession of the mind to drink. In other words, they have a body that cannot take alcohol and a mind that will not leave it alone. Hit them with the medical facts. And when you get their attention, then you can talk to them about the spiritual experience." So he's gone to Acworth and he's going to run into Dr. Bob, the physician, who had repeatedly tried spiritual means to resolve his alcoholic dilemma, but had failed. Dr. Bob already belonged to the Oxford group, and he already knew the solution. He already knew that the solution was going to be he was going to have to find a power greater than himself. But he never pursued the program to the depth necessary because he didn't understand what the problem was. He had part of the solution, but he didn't have enough of it to pursue the program to the depth that it was necessary for him to do. But when the broker gave him Dr. Silkworth's description of alcoholism and its hopelessness, the physician began to pursue the spiritual remedy for his malady. Now, it was a malady in those days, so the insurance company started paying for it, and then it became a disease. With a willingness he had never before been able to muster, he sobered never to drink again up to the moment of his death in 1950. This seemed to prove that one alcoholic could affect another as no other non-alcoholic could. It also indicated that strenuous work, one alcoholic with another, was vital to permanent recovery. One alcoholic talking to another alcoholic, sharing his experience, strength, and hope with his powerlessness over alcohol and the power that he had come to find in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. Hence, the two men set to work almost frantically upon alcoholics arriving in the wards of the Akron City Hospital. Their very first case, a desperate one, recovered immediately and became alcoholic number 3. That's Bill Dotson. A second small group promptly took shape at New York, to be followed in 1937 with the start of a third at Cleveland. Besides these, there were scattered alcoholics who had picked up the basic ideas in Akron or New York, who were trying to form groups in other cities. By late 1937, the number of members having substantial sobriety, now you can imagine what substantial sobriety was, 2 or 3 years, or a year, or all damn day. By late 1937, having substantial sobriety behind them was sufficient to convince the membership that a new light had entered the dark world of the alcoholic. It was now time, the struggling groups thought, to place their message and unique experience before the world. This determination bore fruit in the spring of 1939 by the publication of this volume. The membership had then reached about 100 men and women. The fledgling society, which had been nameless, now began to be called Alcoholics Anonymous, from the name of the title of its own book. We got our name as a fellowship, Alcoholics Anonymous, from the name of the textbook, the program, Alcoholics Anonymous. The flying blind period ended and AA entered a new phase of its pioneering time. They wrote this book so the message of Alcoholics Anonymous and the message of recovery would not become garbled and be lost. You know, if you just carried a message and you just went to meetings and you went to meetings all over the world, this message would and has gotten garbled. With the appearance of the new book, a great deal began to happen. Now, the story, of course, of Clarence Snyder in Cleveland. Clarence was a newcomer. I mean, he was just what they called a punk. You know, he hadn't been sober very long, and he wasn't very old, But he started carrying the message, and he started giving people this book. And he had alcoholics sponsoring other alcoholics with the program in the book who hadn't been sober all week. And they had a baseball pitcher in those days named Bob Feller. And they had this catcher that they had hired to take care of this young pitcher. And he had gotten sober there in Cleveland with Clarence Snyder and his group. And they interviewed him, you know, and put his name in the paper because of his success with this young baseball pitcher. And he said that he had gotten sober in Alcoholics Anonymous, that had started in Cleveland, Ohio, and had been founded by Clarence Snyder. Well, of course, now Bill read about that and got on the train immediately and went to Cleveland to straighten them out and tell them that it doesn't really make any difference who founded this thing. It did get founded.
I thought it was you and Speedy.
Uh-huh. Two principal reasons: the large number of recoveries in reunited homes. These made their impressions everywhere. Of alcoholics who came to AA and really tried, 50% got sober at once and remained that way. 25% sobered up after some relapses, and among the remainder, those who stayed on with AA showed improvement. Other thousands came to a few AA meetings and at first decided they didn't want the program, but great numbers of these, about 2 out of 3, began to return as time passed. Now you can see they had a whole lot better rate of recovery probably than we have today, because the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous and the program of Alcoholics Anonymous was basically the same thing. Now I don't know if that's true today or not. It isn't in some areas. In some areas it is. One more little thing about the history. The basic principles of the AA program, it appears, hold good for individuals with many different lifestyles, just as the program has brought recovery to those of many different nationalities. The 12 steps that summarize the program. And that tells me that the steps as they are written and numbered in the textbook Alcoholics Anonymous and on the plastic sheets and on the little handout cards and all other literature, the steps as they are written and numbered are a summary of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. Step 1 and Step 2 take 60 pages of the textbook to explain. In spite of the great increase in the size and span of this fellowship, at its core it remains simple and personal. Each day, somewhere in the world, recovery begins when one alcoholic talks with another alcoholic, sharing experience, strength, and hope. Butch?
Thanks, Bob. I am a real alcoholic. My name's Butch Clark. Hi, everybody. It is real good to be here and to see a lot of y'all. I know a lot of people here. I've lived in a lot of homes, and this is one of the most important homes I've ever had here in Marietta, because this is where I came to suspect that what I was doing might not be the answer. And this is where I came to find this textbook and some people that guided me in a way to use it. And no matter where I've lived since then, it's been a whole lot nicer place to live. So I am glad to be here. I'm going to talk a little bit about Dr. Silkworth and his opinion, which he formed based on his observations. Now, Silkworth was a doctor who had been working in a hospital in the drunk ward, and he had been taking care of a lot of people who suffered from this disease, even though they didn't know it was a disease. He loved us. He was not an alcoholic, that's important to know, and he loved us in a way that many non-alcoholics cannot love us. He listened, and he listened to the important stuff, and he made observations, and he undoubtedly listened to our whining and our complaining and our excuses, but he also noticed some trends that didn't have anything to do with that. He would sober us up and he would send us back out to our jobs as railroad engineers and doctors and lawyers and sales people. And invariably, we'd end up right back in there. It might be 2 weeks, 2 years, it might be 6 years, but the same people who were so successful and who seemed to be able to think so well in most areas of their life when it came to alcohol always ended up right back in the drunk ward of that hospital. And he made these observations, and undoubtedly he told a lot of people about what he was observing, but we don't know how many may have heard him. But we do know now that Bill Wilson heard and understood what Dr. Silkworth had told him. And that's what the first letter is basically about, how he told Bill of his problem, told him about his problem. And I'm not going to read that. He talks a little bit about the history and what happened after that. But I'm going to start reading on XXIV. Right after he signed that letter, it says, "The physician who at our request gave us this letter has been kind enough to enlarge upon his views in another statement which follows. In this statement, he confirms what we who have suffered alcoholic torture must believe." Now that's me. "That the body of the alcoholic is quite as abnormal as his mind. It did not satisfy us to be told that we could not control our drinking just because we were maladjusted to life, that we were in full flight from reality, or were outright mental defectives. These things were true to some extent, in fact, to a considerable extent with some of us, but we are sure that our bodies were sickened as well. In our belief, any picture of the alcoholic which leaves out this physical factor is incomplete. The doctor's theory that we have an allergy to alcohol interests us. As laymen, our opinion as to its soundness may, of course, mean little. But as ex-problem drinkers, we can say that his explanation makes good sense. It explains many things for which we cannot otherwise account." Now, I know that when I got to the facility where they tried to dry me out and stabilize my body and stabilize my mind, they told me that I had an allergy to alcohol. And I was interested, because I was interested in listening to anything they had to tell me, because I had no longer had alcohol, I had no power whatsoever, and I needed to be accepted, and I needed some human companionship. So I began to agree with people wholesale. However, I had no idea what they were telling me. But it took me another 4.5 or 5 years to dig into this and to really understand what this means to me. Down at the bottom of that paragraph, it says that it explains many things for which we cannot otherwise account. And I'd like to think about some of these things right now. What are the things that I could not account for? One of them was that I had a very loving wife and 2 beautiful children, and I could never account for the fact that I would go into a bar to have a couple of drinks to feel a little bit better, and I would never make it home to be with these people and to love them and to do the things for those people that I needed to do and wanted to do. I couldn't account for that. I couldn't account for the fact that I had a job that I really liked and that paid me probably more than I had ever been worth at the time. But nevertheless, I almost got fired for absenteeism. I could not account for that. I could not account for many things that seemed to be weak will and just a don't give a damn attitude. And this allergy to alcohol explains almost all of the trouble that I have ever been in my life, because it explains how I ended up intoxicated. I'm going to read some more on page XXVI. The doctor says that we believe, and so suggested a few years ago, that the action of alcohol on these chronic alcoholics is a manifestation of an allergy, that the phenomenon of craving is limited to this class and never occurs in the average temperate drinker. These allergic types can never safely use alcohol in any form at all, and once having formed the habit and found they cannot break it, once having lost their self-confidence, their reliance upon things human, their problems pile up on them and become astonishingly difficult to solve. And that is where I was many times, but that is especially where I was when I got to the back door of the treatment facility. I was at one of my bottoms, where I had somehow reached out for help. At that time, it was to save my job, however, and not to quit drinking. But my problems had piled up on me, and I was unable to solve them myself. And let me see if I can figure out why. The doctor says that this outward and visible sign or the manifestation of my allergy is the phenomenon of craving. I need to know that an allergy is an abnormal reaction to a food, beverage, or substance. And I was certainly reacting poorly to alcohol. But now I needed to know that once I trigger this allergy, that I begin the phenomenon of craving, that my body is craving alcohol much as I would crave water if I were thirsty or salt in certain circumstances. I realize now that my brain and my hands had to get this alcohol, but it was my body that was demanding that I have it. So now I realize that what was killing me is a physical allergy to alcohol, and I can understand powerless a little bit better now. I have a very abnormal reaction to it. And knowing this, you might think that I could just probably get up and go on back to East Tennessee with this knowledge and not drink anymore, and I wouldn't get drunk and I wouldn't cause any more trouble and I might not die. But I have another little problem that makes that impossible. Down at the bottom of the page, the doctor talks a little bit more about the rest of my problem. He says men and women drink essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol. The sensation is so elusive that while they admit it is injurious, they cannot after a time differentiate the true from the false. To them, their alcoholic life seems the only normal one. Now, the doctor is telling me, I've gone into the doctor's office and told him how, you know, what the symptoms are, and he's telling me the truth right here. If I have the ability to see it once, he is telling me that I really don't know what's going on as it concerns alcohol, because the nature of the drug is that once I begin to use it, I can't see the truth. Now, I think my life is the only normal one. And if I can't see the truth about how I drink, I'm going to take a drink, I'm going to trigger the allergy, I'm going to end up intoxicated, and I'm going to behave very strangely, like most intoxicated people do. So if I'll follow this chain carefully, I can begin to see what makes me truly powerless over alcohol as a real alcoholic. And it's the beauty of it is it lets me get rid of the guilt that I've been carrying around, thinking that if I had just done differently, that I wouldn't be an alcoholic. It helps me get rid of the blame game, where I've been thinking that if my parents had just done differently, things would be different. Now I can see that the truth is neither one of those things are true. Let's see what else he says. It says that they, that's me, are restless, irritable, and discontented unless they can again experience the sense of ease and comfort which comes at once by taking a few drinks. Drinks which they see others taking with impunity. Now, my disease has caused this. I have developed an obsession to use alcohol to solve my problems. That's what the doctor's telling me. He says that I'm restless, irritable, and discontented unless I can again experience the sense of ease and comfort which always comes by taking a few drinks. Now, I suspect that I'm always restless, irritable, and discontented because I'm getting drunk all the time. I'm stepping outside my value system and doing things that I ordinarily wouldn't do, and I'm beginning to not like me. So I'm always restless, irritable, and discontented. So I'm always trying to use the same old solution. I'm always triggering this allergy. I'm usually ending up drunk and doing things that drunk people do, which, by the way, don't have anything to do with the insanity of the second step. It's just simply intoxicated behavior. And so now I can see that I really can't see the truth about much of anything. I can't see the truth about why I take the first drink, because I have an obsession. And that is a thought that overpowers all other thoughts. It makes it possible for me to believe a lie. I take a drink based on a lie. I trigger the physical allergy to continue to drink, and then I end up intoxicated, being totally unable to see the truth or how I act and learn to react. Now, this is beginning to let me understand that I am truly powerless, and powerless means that I can't help it. So if I can see that I can't help it, then quite possibly I might begin to see if it can be helped some other way. And the doctor said, I'm going to take a break here in a minute and let Bob talk. I don't want him to go to sleep on it. Says, after they have succumbed to the desire again, as so many do, and I did, and the phenomenon of craving develops, as it usually did. However, every now and then I could probably take that drink and not trigger that allergy, and that would reinforce the obsession that I was different and that it was not going to be that way. And every now and then, circumstances reinforced the lie. But the next time, it was usually right back to the same old game. It says, I passed through the well-known stages of a spree, emerging remorseful, with a firm resolution not to drink again. And this is repeated over and over. And unless this person can experience an entire psychic change, there is very little hope of his recovery. Now, I made that resolution many times, but I know now that I had no power to keep it. I was absolutely powerless to keep that resolution because of the obsession. And the doctor is telling me that I'm going to have a psychic change. And I believe that means to me that my mind is going to have to be made different. Because if my mind is left the way it is, I will always believe that lie, or I will eventually believe it again, and I'll take a drink and trigger that allergy, and I won't be welcome in Marietta then. But on the other hand, and strange as this may seem to those who do not understand, once a psychic change has occurred, the very same person who seemed doomed, who had so many problems he despaired of ever solving them, suddenly finds himself easily able to control his desire for alcohol, the only effort necessary being that required to follow a few simple rules. And here are the steps we took. These are the rules that became my design for living, and that's what we'll talk about as we go through the textbook Alcoholics Anonymous. Bob?
I do not hold with those who believe that alcoholism is entirely a problem of mental control. I've had many men who had, for example, worked a period of months on some problem or business deal, which was to be settled on a certain date favorable to them. They took a drink a day or so prior to the date, and then the phenomenon of craving at once became paramount to all other interests, so that the important appointment was not met. These men were not drinking to escape. They were drinking to overcome a craving beyond their mental control. The classifications of alcoholics seems most difficult, and much detail is outside the scope of this book. There are, of course, the psychopaths who are emotionally unstable. We're all familiar with this type. They're always going on the wagon for keeps. They are over-remorseful and make many resolutions, but never a decision. Butch has already said a little something about resolutions and decisions. You know, a resolution is that thing that I said every year around the first of the year, I'll not drink anymore this year. Not one drop less, probably, but not anymore. I won't drink anymore. And that, you know, you get up, you're drunk, sick, and you feel like hell, and you say, I'll never do that again. I'll never in my life drink like that again. And the next thing you know, you're right back at it and roaring again. And then a decision, see, is deciding, making a decision, we decide to do something. When we get down to step three, we're going to make it. Don't say make a resolution. Don't tell us you're going to quit drinking again. Tell us what you're going to do about the way you think about drinking. Make a decision, decide, take some action. And now we're going to talk about the classification of alcoholics. There is the type who is unwilling to admit that he cannot take a drink. He plans various ways of drinking. He changes his brand or his environment. There is the type who always believes that after being entirely free from alcohol for a period of time, he can take a drink without danger. There is the manic depressive type who is perhaps the least understood by his friends, and about whom a whole chapter could be written. Now this is me here, okay? Then there are types entirely normal in every respect except in the effect alcohol has upon them. They are often able, intelligent, and friendly people.
Doesn't say we'll be able to tell the truth about everything.
No. Rigorous self-honesty has not come into the picture yet. All these and many others have one symptom in common. They cannot start drinking without developing the phenomenon craving. Once I take a drink, that drink takes a drink, and then those two drinks will take two drinks, and then those four drinks will take me anywhere they want to go. See, once I always thought I could control my drinking after I started drinking. And until I knew why I can't do that, I couldn't quit drinking. Because I'd see my friends who did this with impunity, it says, you know, with no punishment. They just went and had a couple of drinks and went on about their business. And I had a couple of drinks, and those drinks had a couple of drinks, and then those four drinks would have four or five more, and they would, you know, I broke out in an allergy. I broke out in places I ought not to have been. I broke out over there when I should have been over here. I broke out with her when I shouldn't have been. And I broke out in the disease of alcoholism. Entirely, all these and many others have one symptom in common. They cannot start drinking without developing the phenomenon of craving. This phenomenon, and all the phenomenon is something that happens that we really can't understand, as we have suggested, may be the manifestation, and a manifestation is an outward invisible sign of an allergy which differentiates these people and sets them apart as a distinct entity. Later on, it's going to ask me if I can identify with the fact that I'm bodily and mentally different from my fellows. And this is one of the things that I'm going to have to understand, that I really am bodily and mentally different from my fellows. It has never been, by any treatment which we are familiar, permanently eradicated. Once we got it, we got it. The only relief we have to suggest is entire abstinence. Don't drink. It will give you relief from alcoholism, but it's not recovery. And somebody asked Bill Wilson one time, said, "Bill, how does an alcoholic stay away from taking the next drink?" And he said, "The very nature of the disease tells us we can't do that. We can't stay away from taking the next drink. We have to grow away from it. Because the obsession of the mind will tell me that it's all right for me to drink." All right, let's see. I earnestly advise every alcoholic to read this book through, and though perhaps he came to scoff, he may return to pray. He may remain to pray. All right, now, we're going to look at Bill's story, and Bill's story is in the front of the book here, and I always thought it was just because Bill had a whole lot to do with writing the book, and, you know, maybe a little ego involved, he put his story right up front. After all, he was alcoholic number one. So he was supposed to have been up front. But it's been explained to me that we've left the doctor's office, and the doctor has explained to us what the medical profession, not really the medical profession, Dr. Silkworth thought alcoholism was. Because in the first edition where William D. Silkworth signed this, in the first edition he didn't sign it. He was afraid to. He was afraid they would scoff at him. This was his opinion. It wasn't the medical profession's opinion. It was Dr. Silkworth's opinion. And thank God for his opinion. I think he was probably the first man that ever understood alcoholism was a disease, a physical and mental disease. And we're going to look at Bill's story as an example. And the purpose of Bill's story being right here in the front is we've looked at the disease through the doctor's eyes. Now we're going to see an example. And maybe we can come to sort of identify with Bill Wilson's problem. He can't drink, and he can't quit drinking, and he don't know that. And it's put here to illustrate whether or not, you know, we can identify with the problem. And if we can identify with the problem, then chances are we might be able to identify with the solution. Powerlessness is the problem. We have no power to drink, no power to quit drinking. The only solution we have is power. And that power has to come from a power greater than ourselves. And we'll see later on why that's true, because a sick mind can't fix a sick mind. War fever ran high in the New England town to which we knew young officers from Plattsburgh were assigned. And we were flattered when the first citizens took us to their homes, making us feel heroic. Here was love, applause, war, moments sublime with intervals hilarious. I was part of life at last, and in the midst of the excitement, I discovered liquor. I forgot the strong warnings and the prejudices of my people concerning drink. In time, we sailed for over there. I was very lonely and again turned to alcohol. We landed in England. I visited Winchester Cathedral. Much moved, I wandered outside. My attention was caught by a doggerel on an old tombstone. Here lies a Hampshire grenadier who caught his death drinking cold small beer. A good soldier is ne'er forgot, whether he dies by the musket or by the pot. And they're not talking about marijuana here, I don't think. They're talking about the pot of beer or the pot of liquor. Ominous warning which I failed to heed. 22 and a veteran of foreign wars, I went home at last. If you notice one thing about Bill Wilson's story, he starts off with his drinking. He don't start off with being abused as a child. He starts off with his drinking. He doesn't say anything about his mama putting him on the pot backwards, you know, and all of the things that might have caused me to be an alcoholic. He just starts off with, he was lonely, he took a drink, and drinking made him feel good. Drinking made him feel good. It let him be a part of. And he goes searching for it the rest of his life until he gets sober. I fancied myself a leader. For had not the men of my battery given me a special token of appreciation, my talent for leadership, I imagined, would place me at the head of vast enterprises which I would manage with the utmost assurance. I took a night law course and then obtained employment as investigator for a surety company. The drive for success was on. Now I can identify with Bill Wilson in this next sentence. I'd prove to the world that I was important. All my life, that's what I wanted to be, special and important. And I'll tell you a little story about that. I'll tell that later. I'd prove to the world I was important. My work took me about Wall Street, and little by little I became interested in the market. Many people lost money, but some became very rich. Why not I? I studied economics and business as well as law. Potential alcoholic that I was, I nearly failed my law course. At one of the finals, I was too drunk to think or write. Though my drinking was not yet continuous, it disturbed my wife. We had long talks when I would steal her forebodings by telling her that men of genius conceive their best projects when drunk. That the most majestic constructions of philosophic thought were so derived. I convinced my wife that I was all right because I told her that I played hard, I worked hard, and I played hard. You know, when I was working, I was working. And when I was playing, I was playing.
She knew that was bullcrap back then, too.
Yeah, she knew that. By the time I had completed the course, I knew the law was not for me. Now, Bill's going to change jobs on the way home from work, you know. I can identify with Bill Wilson. The inviting maelstrom of Wall Street had me in its grip. He likes that excitement. Out of this alloy of drink and speculation, I commenced to forge the weapon that would one day turn in its flight like a boomerang and all but cut me to ribbons. You know what a boomerang is. That's one that you throw out and it comes back. You know what it is if you throw it out and it don't come back?
No way.
Just a damn stick.
No.
I rightly imagined that they would someday have a great rise. I failed to persuade my broker friends to send me out looking over factories and management, but my wife and I decided to go anyway. Now, this is where Bill and Lois get on that motorcycle, and Bill was a tall fella. I don't know, he's probably 6'2", 6'4", which is extremely tall to me. And They had a picture of him in the sidecar of that motorcycle, and Lois driving, and him piled up in that sidecar. Now that had to be a sight coming down the road in 1930, and you know, that had to be a sight. For the next few years, fortune threw money and applause my way. I had arrived. He's there. He's done it. My judgment and ideas were followed by many to the tune of paper millions. The great boom of the late 20s was seething and swelling. Drink was taking an important and exhilarating part in my life.
I can relate.
I can relate to that. An important and exhilarating part of my life. There was loud talk in the jazz places uptown. Everyone spent in thousands and chattered in millions. Rusty from over to Reba's Club said one time that we were drama junkies. And I believe it's true. Scoffers could scoff and be damned. I made a host of fair weather friends. My drinking assumed more serious proportions.
I can relate.
Continuing all day and almost every night.
Now, Bill doesn't know he's an alcoholic now, and his disease is escalating.
The remonstrances of my friends terminated in a row, and I became a lone wolf. People began to say, Bill, you're drinking too much. You're drinking is trouble. You're drinking is you're going to have to go. So Bill did. He went. But he didn't quit drinking. He just went somewhere else like me to drink. I went where they were people who were worse off, I thought, than I was. I went down on the river. I thought, you know, I can go down there and I can drive an Oldsmobile and I can be a big shot railroad engineer. And I can be a drunk just like that bum sitting next to me, but I don't have to think I am. And I can convince him that I'm not. Of course, I wound up buying most of his drinks. There were unhappy scenes in our sumptuous apartment.
Homelessness is not his problem, is it?
No. There had been no real infidelity. Now, I don't doubt Bill Wilson, but I heard the story. Joe and Charlie tell that story about Bill come home one time with his coat and tie and shirt and shoes on, no breeches. And he told Lois, we're good. I mean, we're good at convincing people, you know. He said he took his breeches off and rolled them up and used them for a pillow. And then when he left, he just forgot them. And, you know, I guess she must have bought that. For loyalty to my wife, helped at times by extreme drunkenness, kept me out of those scrapes, and I can identify with Bill.
If you can't remember it, you didn't do it.
That's right. Not guilty. Let's go on over here to, let's see. Liquor ceased to be a luxury. It became a necessity on page 5. Bathtub gin, 2 bottles a day, and often 3, got to be routine. Sometimes a small deal would net me a few $100s, and I would pay my bills at the bars and delicatessens. This went on endlessly, and I began to waken it very early in the morning, shaking violently. A tumbler full of gin, followed by 6 bottles of beer, would be required if I were to eat any breakfast. I don't identify with Bill here because once I started drinking, there was no breakfast. Nevertheless, I still thought I could control the situation, and there were periods of sobriety which renewed my wife's hope. Bill can't see the truth about the way he's drinking, can he? Gradually, things got worse. The house was taken over by the mortgage holder. My mother-in-law died, and my wife and father-in-law became very ill. Then I got a promising opportunity. Stocks were at the low point of 1932, and I had somehow formed a group to buy. I was to share generously in the profits. Then I went on a prodigious bender, and that chance vanished. Now, as I understand this story, Bill went to this meeting, and these guys had some Applejack. And they kept passing it around and offering a drink to Bill. And Bill said, no, I don't drink anymore. I can't drink. I had to quit. And then he got to thinking, see, the most dangerous time in an alcoholic's life is when he ain't drinking, but he's thinking. And Bill got to thinking, well, I never have had no Applejack. That's me with that thing that come out on the market several years ago called Zima. Every time I'd go to the grocery store, I'd see that Zima. And it's like them old boys up there in Tennessee told me, you know, you can see through it, it won't hurt you. They said, if you're going to drink that see-through liquor. You know, either what they call vodka, see-through liquor. They also told me something else. They said, if you're going to be a drunk, you've got to stay in shape. Weekend drinking are key. And I took them at their word. I woke up. This had to be stopped. I saw that I could not take so much as one drink. I was through forever. Bill's made that resolution, hadn't he? Now he's going to drag out willpower, and he's going to put that willpower to work. Before then, I had written lots of sweet promises, but my wife happily observed that this time I meant business, and so I did. He's made a resolution, and he's made it stout. My wife found a cookbook one time where I had signed one of those resolutions. After this date, I will never again for the rest of my life take another drink of alcohol. After this date. It wasn't that day. It was after some friends of mine were coming. I didn't remember this, but she did, of course. It was after some friends of mine were going to come up from Florida to watch a Tennessee football game with me. And then I was going to quit drinking. So I signed the resolution like on Tuesday to quit next Wednesday, say, or next Thursday or something. Shortly afterward, I came home drunk. There had been no fight. Where had been my high resolve? I simply didn't know. Now, Bill's telling the truth here. He don't know. He has an illness of ignorance. He don't know what his problem is. It hadn't even come to mind. Someone had pushed a drink my way, and I had taken it. Was I crazy? I began to wonder, for such an appalling lack of perspective seemed near being just that. Renewing my resolve, I tried again. Confidence began to replace by cocksureness. I could laugh at the gin mills. Now I had what it takes. I went in a bar in Chattanooga one time and they said, what'll it be? You know, the usual. I said, oh no, I don't drink anymore. I'm through drinking. I can't handle drinking. I'm just through. They're going to fire me for drinking, and it's beginning to hurt me, and it's beginning to hurt my family, so I'm going to just quit. Well, hell, less than a week, I was back in there drunk in the rodeo goat. And they said, what happened to the idea that you was going to quit drinking? I said, well, I just changed my mind. One day I walked into a cafe to telephone. In no time I was beating in the bar asking myself how it happened. What happened to Bill? Obsession of the mind. The thought that overcomes all other thought. Imagination being stronger than willpower. Bill was in the bar. He imagined how he would feel if he could just have a drink, so he had a drink. I told myself I would manage better next time, but I might as well get good and drunk. And I did. I'm trying to read down to the goose hung high, but I don't know if I'm going to make it or not. The mind and body are marvelous mechanisms. For mine endured this agony for 2 more years. Sometimes I stole from my wife's slender purse when the morning terror and madness were on me. I can identify with Bill Wilson. That's the state I was in when I got here. Again, I swayed dizzily before an open window or the medicine cabinet where there were poison, cursing myself for a weakling. Bill don't know he's sick. He thinks he's weak. He thinks he's inadequate. He thinks he's a sinner. He thinks he's crazy. He thinks he's sorry as hell. He don't know he has a disease. There were flights from city to country and back as my wife and I sought escape. Then came the night when the physical and mental torture was so hellish, I feared I would burst through my window, sash and all. Somehow I managed to drag my mattress to a lower floor, lest I suddenly leap. A doctor came with a heavy sedative. Next day found me drinking both gin and sedative. I can identify with Bill Wilson and his disease also. I went to the doctor and the doctor diagnosed my problem as a Valium deficiency and prescribed for me Valium. And I'd get up in the morning and take, of course, supposed to take one, and one will do you good, two will fix you right on up. And I'd take a couple of Valium and wash it down with beer or maybe vodka and orange juice. I was a health nut, see. I wouldn't drink vodka straight out of the bottle. I did, of course, in the end, but I drank it with orange juice and kidding myself, you know, that I was getting my vitamins. My brother-in-law is a physician, and through his kindness and that of my mother, I was placed in a nationally known hospital, Towns Hospital, for the mentally and physical rehabilitation of alcoholics. Under the so-called belladonna treatment, my brain cleared. Hydrotherapy and mild exercise helped much. Best of all, I met a kind doctor who explained that although certainly selfish and foolish, I had been seriously ill, bodily and mentally. Bill finds out he's got a disease, or at least he hears the doctor say that. It relieved me somewhat to learn that in alcoholics the will is amazingly weakened when it comes to combating liquor, though it often remains strong in other respects. My incredible behavior in the face of a desperate desire to stop was explained. Understanding myself now, I fared forth in high hopes. For 3 or 4 months, the goose hung high.
Yay.
I went to town regularly and even made a little money. Surely this was the answer, self-knowledge. Do y'all know where the term goose hung high came from? It was a term used in Europe before the days of refrigeration. They'd kill a goose for a holiday, say for Christmas or something like that, and they'd hang it up and let it just hang outside until it began to deteriorate and it would be easy to pluck, and when you cook it, it would be tender to eat. It would begin to deteriorate, to rot, and you could pluck it and cook it. And that's when we started the Goose Hung High meeting. That's the reason we called it that, because we figured if you were going to come and hear one person talk about the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous, week after week after week, you had to be pretty well ready to be plucked and damn near rotten. You want to take a little break?
That'd be fine.
You want to take a little break? Let's stand up a little. I went a little farther.
We're gonna keep looking at Bill and listening to Bill, and I've noticed a couple things about him. He has talked only about what happened. He hasn't given us a lot of his theory. It's interesting, or it's important for me to understand that Bill doesn't know. He's writing this story as if he does not know what his problem is, and we've seen a lot of the places where he's drinking for effect, and his disease is escalating pretty fast. And I'm going to start reading again on page 7, right there where we left off. It said, surely this was the answer, self-knowledge. Not. But it was not, for the frightful day came when I drank once more. The curve of my declining moral and bodily health fell off like a ski jump. After a time, I returned to the hospital. This was the finish, the curtain, it seemed to me. My weary and despairing wife was informed that it would all end with heart failure during delirium tremens, or I would develop a wet brain, perhaps within a year. She would soon have to give me over to the undertaker or the asylum. They did not need to tell me. I knew and almost welcomed the idea. It was a devastating blow to my pride. I, who had thought so well of myself and my abilities, of my capacity to surmount obstacles, was cornered at last. Now I was to plunge into the dark, joining that endless procession of sots who had gone on before. I thought of my poor wife. There had been much happiness after all. What would I not give to make amends? But that was over now. No words can tell of the loneliness and despair I found in that bitter morass of self-pity. Quicksand stretched around me in all directions. I had met my match. I had been overwhelmed. Alcohol was my master.
Bill's without hope now. He has no hope.
And that's as good a description of step one as I've ever seen. But interestingly enough, you can't scare an alcoholic. And even though he knows that something's seriously wrong, it's not enough. Trembling, I stepped from the hospital a broken man. Fear sobered me for a bit. Then came the insidious insanity of that first drink, and on Armistice Day 1934, I was off again. Everyone became resigned to the certainty that I would have to be shut up somewhere or would stumble along to a miserable end. How dark it is before the dawn. In reality, that was the beginning of my last debauch. I was soon to be catapulted into what I like to call the fourth dimension of existence. I was to know happiness, peace, and usefulness in a way of life that is incredibly more wonderful as time passes. Sounds to me like he's describing peace of mind. Near the end of that bleak November, I sat drinking in my kitchen. With a certain satisfaction, I reflected there was enough gin concealed about the house to carry me through that night and the next day. My wife was at work. I wondered whether I dared hide a full bottle of gin near the head of our bed. I would need it before daylight. Now, this is the first time that's ever struck me, but he mentions that his wife was at work. And I know now how important that probably was to him. He probably loves her more than anything in the world, yet it was important that she was not there. He did not want her around him at that time, and I can relate to Bill Wilson's feelings. My musing was interrupted by the telephone. The cheery voice of an old school friend asked if he might come over. Now, this is Ebby Thatcher. He's the person who had been saved from the sanitarium by a couple of people from the Oxford groups. Of course, I'm going to read that, so I'll tell that later. But Ebby was an old friend, and here he was coming to see Bill. He was sober. It was years since I could remember his coming to New York in that condition. I was amazed. Rumor had it that he had been committed for alcoholic insanity. I wondered how he had escaped. Of course, he would have dinner, and then I could drink openly with him. Unmindful of his welfare, I thought only of recapturing the spirit of other days. Now, I can relate to the feelings that must be going on within Bill right now. The up and the down and the relief that he is seeing possibly coming when he's able to drink with his friend. There was that time we had chartered an airplane to complete a jag. His coming was an oasis in this dreary desert of futility. The very thing, an oasis. Drinkers are like that. The door opened and he stood there, fresh skinned and glowing. There was something about his eyes. He was inexplicably different. What had happened? I pushed a drink across the table. He refused it. Disappointed but curious, I wondered what had got into the fellow. He wasn't himself. "Come, what's all this about?" I queried. He looked straight at me. Simply but smilingly, he said, "I've got religion." I was aghast. So that was it. Last summer, an alcoholic crackpot, and now I suspected a little cracked about religion. He had that starry-eyed look. Yes, the old boy was on fire, all right. But bless his heart, let him rant. Besides, my gin would last longer than his preaching. I started to say my power would last longer than his. But he did no ranting. In a matter-of-fact way, he told how two men had appeared in court, persuading the judge to suspend his commitment.
Those two men were Roland H., as I understand it. This is also a history book also, and as a fellow in New York has made a tape about the history of the big book Alcoholics Anonymous. And he tells in there that these two men were Roland H. and Seaford Graves. And Seaford Graves was the son of the judge who was trying Ebby. And the judge told him, he said, if you'll go with this guy, Roland H., and he'll do for you the same thing he's done for my son, Seaford Graves, I'll turn you over to him and I won't put you in the insane asylum. Right.
They had told of a simple religious idea, step two, and a practical program of action, that'd be 3 through 12. That was 2 months ago, and the result was self-evident. It worked. And he had come to pass his experience along to me if I cared to have it. I was shocked, but interested. Certainly I was interested. I had to be, for I was hopeless. He talked for hours. Childhood memories rose before me. I could almost hear the sound of the preacher's voice as I sat on still Sundays way over there on the hillside. There was that proffered temperance pledge I never signed, my grandfather's good-natured contempt of some church folk and their doings, his insistence that the spheres really had their music, but his denial of the preacher's right to tell him how he must listen, his fearlessness as he spoke of these things just before he died. These recollections welled up from the past. They made me swallow hard. Now, Bill's beginning to suspect that this power may work for him, too. He's going through some mental dancing around here. Sometimes I use another word, but nevertheless, he's trying to find a loophole that he might crawl through. That wartime day in old Winchester Cathedral came back. I had always believed in a power greater than myself. I had often pondered these things. I was not an atheist. Few people really are. For that means blind faith in the strange proposition that this universe originated in a cipher and aimlessly rushes nowhere. My intellectual heroes, the chemists, the astronomers, even the evolutionists, suggested vast laws and forces at work. Despite contrary indications, I had little doubt that a mighty purpose and rhythm underlay all. How could there be so much of precise and immutable law and no intelligence? I simply had to believe in the spirit of the universe, who knew neither time nor limitation, but that was as far as I had gone. He had not even bothered to see how this might relate to him. With ministers in the world's religions, I parted right there. When they talked of a God personal to me who was love, superhuman strength, and direction, I became irritated and my mind snapped shut against such a theory. To Christ I conceded the certainty of a great man, not too closely followed by those who claimed him, his moral teaching most excellent. Now this is a good time for me to mention the fact that the word moral really means honesty or truth. Of course, it's moral too, but that's a word that used to frighten me. So I like to try to change that in my head every time I run across it. It just simply means truth, even when they're talking about Jesus. His moral teaching, most excellent. For myself, I had adopted those parts which seemed convenient and not too difficult. The rest I disregarded. There's got to be a harder way I can identify. Now, this might be a good time for me to share a little bit of my experience as to why I think this happened to me. I can remember being taken to many Sunday schools and Bible schools, and as a matter of fact, I believe I have had quite a bit of training in about 5 different religions. I don't remember very much of it because I didn't think it pertained to me. When I was at the age of about 14, I found a power that worked so well for me that I did not need any other power. And I didn't know this. This was not a conscious decision that I made that I said, no, this is my power and I don't need to know about yours. This all happened on a subconscious level, but it's as clear as day now. If alcohol still did for me what it did for me at the age of 14, 15, and 16, I would be out there drinking tonight, folks. I wouldn't be sitting here trying to figure out a way to stay sober and following these instructions. I know that I would be drinking if it still did for me what it did for me then. And that is what happened to all my religious upbringing and the teaching and everything else. I simply reacted poorly to it because I didn't need it. It did not make sense to try something else when what I had worked so well, even though I didn't know it at the time. I'm going to skip a paragraph, and I'm going to read here where Bill has some living proof of what's going on in his mind. It says, "But my friend sat before me, and he made the point-blank declaration that God had done for him what he could not do for himself. His human will had failed. Doctors had pronounced him incurable. Society was about to lock him up. Like myself, he had admitted complete defeat. Then he had, in effect, been raised from the dead, suddenly taken from the scrap heap to a level of life better than the best he had ever known. Had this power originated in him? Obviously it had not. There had been no more power in him than there was in me at that minute. And this was none at all. So Bill's beginning to suspect that that there is some hope for him. And just a few minutes ago, he was hopeless, and he had admitted that. And this is what we're doing, is we're looking at Bill, talking to a real alcoholic, and watching him come to understand what his problem is so that he can understand what his solution is. And I've often found that the solution is usually stated in the problem. And the problem usually is that I am lacking something. No matter what that problem is, if I'm out in a car, I might be gasless. But if I try to put a battery in it, that's going to be the wrong solution. So the first step in solving any problem on this earth, no matter what the problem, is to identify it clearly. And so Bill is beginning to clearly identify his problem. And once he has done that, then the solution will just, it'll be obvious. It says, despite the living example of my friend, there remained in me the vestiges of my old prejudice. The word God still aroused a certain antipathy. When the thought was expressed that there might be a God personal to me, this feeling was intensified. I didn't like the idea. I could go for such conceptions as creative intelligence, universal mind, or spirit of nature, but I resisted the thought of a czar of the heavens, however loving his sway might be. I have since talked with scores of men who felt the same way. Now Bill begins to lay aside prejudice. And the next statement, his friend is simply man to man giving him permission to do the only thing that he could ever do anyway. It says, my friend suggested what then seemed a novel idea. He said, why don't you choose your own conception of God?
Left religion right there now and went to a spiritual program. God as you understand God.
And if we'll think about that for a minute, that's all we could ever have anyway. The man has given me permission to do all I could possibly do. That's the only thing I could, the only God I could ever have is my own conception, no matter what church I went to. So he's given me permission to do all I can do. That statement hit me hard. It melted the icy intellectual mountain in whose shadow I had lived and shivered many years. I stood in the sunlight at last. Now this is a good description of step two. It was only a matter of being willing to believe in a power greater than myself. Nothing more was required of me to make my beginning. I saw that growth could start from that point. Upon a foundation of complete willingness, I might build what I saw in my friend. Would I have it? Of course I would. Now Bill suspects that he can have the same thing that has happened to his friend. He understands that he cannot help his problem. He's powerless. That's the first conclusion that he has to come to. The second conclusion that Bill makes is that, yes, he might have a hope of having this happen to him. That would be step two. Two conclusions. We have to have two issues in order to have a debate, and we're getting ready to end the debate when we get over here when it comes time to make a decision. But we've got a lot more information. They're going to tell us time after time in a different way exactly what our problem is and what our solution is going to have to be. And they're going to do this consistently. And they're not going to change the message. They're only going to change the wording a little bit and change the stories so that we can use our knowledge to try to learn something new. But the message will stay clear-cut, and it will stay the same, and they're going to tell us over and over again, because that's how I had to be told, was over and over and over again. Do you have anything?
The real significance of my experience in the cathedral burst upon me. For a brief moment, I had needed and wanted God. You remember when he first got to Europe and he was in the cathedral and he was scared because he didn't know what was going to happen to him. He needed and wanted God. But then, of course, the war and the him being the captain and everything. You want me to read a line?
You can read.
All right. We're going to watch Bill here take the steps before the steps were written. But if you'll follow along with me, we'll go along here and see where he takes the steps.
Now, this is on December 10th and 11th, 1934, if anybody's a history buff. Go ahead, Bob.
At the hospital, I was separated from alcohol for the last time. treatment seemed wise, for I showed signs of delirium tremens. This is the third time he's been in the alcohol hospital. There I humbly offered myself to God, step three, as I then understood him, to do with me as he would. I placed myself unreservedly under his care and direction. Under his care and direction. I admitted for the first time that of myself I was nothing, that without him I was lost. I ruthlessly faced my sins and became willing to have my newfound friend take them away root and branch. I have not had a drink since.
That's
step four.
Four, six, and seven.
Six and seven. My schoolmate visited me, and I fully acquainted him with my problems and deficiencies.
Five.
We made a list of people I had hurt or toward whom I felt resentment.
Eight.
I expressed my entire willingness to approach these individuals, admitting my wrong. Never was I to be critical of them. I was to right all such matters to the utmost of my ability.
Well, that's what was to become 8 and 9. The steps aren't written yet.
I was to test my thinking by the new God consciousness within. Common sense would thus become uncommon sense. I remember saying, I can't do this. It don't make any sense to me. It ain't supposed to. And you're right, you can't do it. But with help, you can. With God's help, you can do these things. And I said, well, I can't do these. You know, I don't understand it. I can't do it. I was to sit quietly when in doubt. Now, this is not me at all. Asking only for direction and strength to meet my problems as he would have me. Never was I to pray for myself except as my request bore on my usefulness to others. Step 11. Then only might I expect to receive, but that would be in great measure. My friend promised when these things having been done, I would enter upon a new relationship with my Creator. He'd had a spiritual awakening, a personality change sufficient to stay sober. That I would have the elements of a way of living which answered all my problems. Belief in a power of God, belief in the power of God, suspicion in the power of God, plus enough willingness, honesty, and humility to establish and maintain the new order of things were the essential requirements. Simple, but not easy. A price had to be paid. It meant destruction of self-centeredness. I must turn in all things to the Father of Light, who presides over us all. Now, they're only asking an alcoholic to do two things, give up self-centeredness and give up his liquor. That's all they're asking us to do.
You can have the liquor.
Yeah. But don't take that self-centeredness. Simple, but not easy. A price has to be paid. But a price has to be paid if we're real alcoholics and we don't take this program seriously and we don't do these steps and do what we're supposed to do with them, will be paid. Because we'll go back to doing what we always did. We'll go back to being that knee-walking, babbling idiot drunk that we were basically when we got here. So a price is going to have to be paid. These were revolutionary and drastic proposals, but the moment I fully accepted them, the effect was electric. There was a sense of victory, followed by such a peace and serenity as I had never known. There was utter confidence. I felt lifted up as though the great clean wind of a mountaintop blew through and through. God comes to most men gradually, but his impact on me was sudden and profound. Now, I've been told that we need to keep in mind that Bill was in a detox center.
He was ready to move in and help him.
He was ready to move in and help him. For a moment, I was alarmed and called my friend, the doctor, to ask if I was still sane. He listened in wonder as I talked. Finally, he shook his head, saying, something has happened to you. I don't understand. But you'd better hang on to it. Anything is better than the way you were. The good doctor now sees many men who have such experiences. He knows that they are real. While I lay in the hospital, the thought came that there were thousands of hopeless alcoholics who might be glad to have what had been so freely given me. Perhaps I could help some of them. They, in turn, might help might work with others. And the thought of and the idea of the fellowship and the program of Alcoholics Anonymous is born right here. Bill gets to thinking there's a world of alcoholics out there that just might need some help.
And he might get rich doing it.
Yeah. Yeah, Bill was, you know, in how it works, it says we are not saints. And this bunch wasn't saints either. Because I've heard it said that if it had been left up to Bob, that Alcoholics Anonymous would have just been another religion. If it's left up to Bill, he'd have sold the damn thing, you know. He'd have promoted it and sold it. All right, Butch.
Thanks, Bob. Now, Bill has had a vital spiritual experience. And we sometimes read what's been written right there and think that we're going to have a burning bush type experience. And pretty soon we're going to read what we're looking for in the back of the book. But I believe that Bill had a fast spiritual awakening because he did the work that was required to bring it about pretty fast. I know that when I'm working hard, I feel better. And when I'm doing things that I'm supposed to be doing rapidly, then I get rapid results. I think that's as simple as it is right here. I don't believe that it was anything that might be put on the Discovery Channel yet. While I lay in the hospital, the thought came that there were thousands of hopeless alcoholics who might be glad to have what had been so freely given to me. Perhaps I could help some of them. They in turn might work with others. My friend had emphasized the absolute necessity of demonstrating these principles in all my affairs. Particularly was it imperative to work with others as he had worked with me. Faith without works was dead, he said, and how appallingly true for the alcoholic. For if an alcoholic failed to perfect and enlarge his spiritual life through work and self-sacrifice for others, he could not survive the certain trials and low spots ahead. If he did not work, he would surely drink again, and if he drank, he would surely die. Then faith would be dead indeed. With us, it is just like that. Now, they're telling me what I'm going to have to do right there in that paragraph. I'm losing my mic, and then I'll really be powerless. But I can't understand it the way so many thousands of people and millions of people had understood it up until this time. Simply to clean house, trust God, and serve others. Many people have done this, and they didn't have to be beaten down by alcohol in order to do it. But it's going to have to be laid out very carefully and very simply for me. And I believe it's going to have to be done in such a way where I'm actually going to get to think it's almost my idea. And that's how Bill does it. Thank God he was a con man, because he figured out that he had to con himself in order to recover. And I believe that's what happened for my benefit. My wife and I abandoned ourselves with enthusiasm to the idea of helping other alcoholics to a solution of their problems. It was fortunate, for my old business associates remained skeptical for a year and a half, during which I found little work. I was not too well at the time and was plagued by waves of self-pity and resentment. This sometimes nearly drove me back to drink, but I soon found that when all other measures failed, work with another alcoholic would save the day. Many times I have gone to my old hospital in despair. On talking to a man there, I would be amazingly lifted up and set on my feet. It is a design for living that works in rough going.
The work is hard, the reward is great.
And I'd like to mention that Bill has already done what was to become the 12 steps. That, I believe, is important too. In other words, I thought that I could work with other alcoholics and maybe get by and not have to take these steps. And I did get some power from that, the wonderful power of human love, but it was not enough power to bring about a personality change sufficient to stay sober. It was enough power to keep me dry and sober long enough to maybe get sober. We commenced to make many fast friends, and a fellowship has grown up among us, of which it is a wonderful thing to feel a part. The joy of living we really have, even under pressure and difficulty. I have seen hundreds of families set their feet in the path that really goes somewhere, have seen the most impossible domestic situations righted, feuds and bitterness of all sorts wiped out. I have seen men come out of asylums and resume a vital place in the lives of their families and communities. Business and professional men have regained their standing. There is scarcely any form of trouble and misery which has not been overcome among us. In one western city and its environs, there are 1,000 of us and our families. We meet frequently so that newcomers may find the fellowship they seek. At these informal gatherings, one may often see from 50 to 200 persons. We are growing in numbers and power. And there's an asterisk, and at the bottom of the page it says, in 1992, AA is composed of approximately 96,000 groups.
And what in the world would happen if we had 96,000 groups of alcoholics practicing the principles of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous? This world would be completely and absolutely changed forever if we had 96,000 groups. You know, in Northern Ireland, where the Catholics and the Protestants don't have nothing to do with each other, they sit in AA meetings together. They have to, see, because they have a common problem and a common solution. In places all over the world with different people who have absolutely nothing to do with each other, except in the fellowship and in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And they, you know, they don't have no room, there's no room for argument. Common problem and a common solution.
An alcoholic in his cups is an unlovely creature. Our struggles with them are variously strenuous, comic, and tragic. One poor chap committed suicide in my home. He could not or would not see our way of life. There is, however, a vast amount of fun about it all. I suppose some would be shocked at our seeming worldliness and levity. But just underneath there is deadly earnestness. Faith has to work 24 hours a day in and through us, or we perish. Most of us feel we need look no further for utopia. We have found it. We have it with us right here and now. Each day, my friend's simple talk in our kitchen multiplies itself in a widening circle of peace on earth and goodwill to men. And this was signed by Bill W., the co-founder of AA, and he didn't have to take a drink until his death on January 24th, 1971. And so what I'm beginning to learn is that the power of the fellowship supports me until I can study and find out what my problem is and do a few simple things and allow the power of a spiritual experience to change my personality, which is the way I think, feel, and act on a permanent basis, so that I'll no longer become restless, irritable, and discontented enough to believe the lie that will let me take a drink. That's all I have on
that. All right. The Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous is strong. It kept me at least dry. You know, people ask me sometimes how long I've been sober, and I say, I don't rightly know. I came in the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous in 1978. But when I came on the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, was several meetings later. It was on down the road, because I was not one of these people like I'm sure most of y'all are, that just come in here and jump right on the program and took off with it, you know, because I didn't do it that way. I did it my way for a while, until my way got to where it wasn't working. And then I took off searching and looking. And, you know, that's a recovering alcoholic, searching and looking is a dangerous person, especially if he's searching and looking by himself. You know, and going to meetings and saying, well, I think, you know, my thought on that is, and somebody finally told me just to shut up. I didn't have no thoughts on that, you know. I hadn't done nothing, so I didn't need to be talking about it. You know, when he's talking about having fun in these meetings, we had a guy come to Gem City one night, and he went downtown and reported us for entirely too much levity in that group. Entirely too much levity in that group, you know, and we do get kind of levitate down there occasionally, because I believe this thing is supposed to be fun, you know. And if I come here, I know y'all have seen that guy that's got all the years, that sits in the meeting, you know, like the old boy up in Tennessee where I went to meetings at my dad's group. And he's sitting right at the door as you come in, you know. And he gives you one of these sideways, look like a turtle, you know, looking up at you. And he'll say, "Won't you get over and hush? Get over and sit down and hush. They've seen you. I got 30 damn years of sobriety. You want what I got? Sit down over and hush." I told him one night, I said, "Mr. Jim, I don't want what you got. You know, if I can't come here and be happy, joyous, and free, I don't have no other choice. This is the place that I have found in this program exactly what I've been looking for all my life, a power greater than myself. I think I drank to the Spirit. I think even when I was drinking, I was looking for God. I was looking for a power greater than myself that would give me a sense of direction and the power to carry that out. I think that's what I was looking for, and I know that's what I found here." All right? We're going to hang it up a little early, I guess, about 5 minutes.
Now, after you've had some fun with Bob, you know, I'm liable to walk up to you and ask you some tough questions. I'm liable to walk up to somebody and I'll say, "Do you know what your problem is?" And you'll probably want to answer me. You'll probably want to answer me, and I hope that you've been reading a big book and understand exactly what your problem is, because that is 50% of our recovery, I believe. And when a man comes in this room after we've showed him that we can have some fun, I believe that it is our job, I believe it's our duty, and I believe it's our direction, according to these 12 steps, to consistently carry a consistent message to that man or woman. Because they have a couple of questions when they get here. And one of them is, "Now that I know that I can't drink like I used to, why can't I quit?" And those are the questions that really need to be answered. Not, you know, "When's my wife coming back?" Because we don't know. You know, I've tried to answer those questions, and to be honest with you, I really don't know if she's going to come back. And when am I going to have a job, or when am I going to have a place to sleep? Well, in this day and time, there's usually a place to eat and a place to sleep, and we can help them find that. And I believe it's our job to be good neighbors and to be good fellow human beings. But when it comes to Alcoholics Anonymous, for me, for this alcoholic, my life depends on the clarity of this message. I have two daughters and potential alcoholics, and their lives may one day depend on the clarity of this message. And when they walk into a room, my God, I hope someone is able to answer those two questions for them. And that's why they wrote this book. They wrote this book so that we wouldn't have 96,000 different messages. Our personalities are different as night and day. And some of us have had some tragic circumstances. Some of us have had some funny circumstances. But if we're real alcoholics, what we have in common is that we cannot drink and we cannot quit. And that's the only thing that we certainly have in common. Now, there are many, many other things. But there may be an old lady sitting in the back of the room who's never had a speeding ticket. She's never been in jail. She's never been cussed out, nor has she ever cussed anybody else out. She can't relate to any of the war stories that we've told time and time again. Yet she's got a bottle of cooking sherry under that cabinet. And when she starts nipping on that cooking sherry, she can't get out of it, and she falls down and she hurts herself. And she cannot understand why she can't drink and she can't quit, because she doesn't even know it. And we've got to help her too. And we've got to carry a message that will help her too. And I'll get off my soapbox and thank you very much for coming and listening to us tonight. It sure has helped me.